Okay, hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On today's show, I'm going to do the second part to one I did last week. Who was David Ferry asking that question? And I read through Garrison's On the Trail of the Assassins and some of his comments on Ferry. And then I also read from Heritage of Stone. And then I went and read some of the interview with Ferry that took place and was located in what I thought was an FBI file at the time. It wasn't. It was part of an FBI file, but it was really the HSCA, so the House Select Committee on Assassinations file that was released in 2017. And in that file was the interview with Garrison, Associate District Attorney, when he sat down and interviewed David Ferry. So that was something I read. And then Ferry, like, conveniently just dropped dead. He had what they called, like, according to the coroner, he had some kind of stroke, like a very heavy, like a serious stroke at the back of his brain. But he was interviewed that last part of the part one. The interview was February 18th, 1967. Then he conveniently died February 22nd, 1967, just as Garrison's investigation was ongoing. So that was from the HSCA file, which I will also go through, but I want to read from the HSCA report. So this is volume 10 on its own section about Ferry. So, and it may go over some of the stuff I talked about in Garrison, unlikely about the material about this interview they had with Ferry, where he shows he's pretty confident, he's pretty optimistic, and doesn't seem to be worried about anything in 67, and then dies 4 days later. Incredible. But there's other things in this file that are remarkable. There's his lawsuit. Well, Eastern Airlines fired him, and then there's just the deposition where he's not complying at all with Eastern Airlines, and there actually is, like, his lawyer, Gill, is the same lawyer as Marcello. And you'll see Marcello in this account, too, because Ferry is spending time with Marcello before the assassination. It's pretty interesting how closely associated he was to Marcello. And there, like I've stated before, the last one, there are reports not confirmed that it was Ferry who flew down to Central America to pick up Marcello when he was kicked out of the government by Robert F. Kennedy, right? So Ferry really is a fascinating character. Maybe not, people didn't understand as much about him like when they read or watched the movie JFK or something like that. So I'm going to read from this file, like I said, and I'll go through the HSCA and just kind of do an overview. So like I said, this is the HSCA report, House Select Committee on Assassinations Report, Volume 10, title, David Ferry. In connection with this investigation of anti-Castro Cuban groups, the committee examined the activities of David William Ferry, an alleged associate of Lee Harvey Oswald. Among other contentions, it had been charged that Ferry was involved with at least one militant group of Cuban exiles, and they had made flights into Cuba in support of their counter-revolutionary activities there. So the HSCA is 1970s, and then they found the picture of Ferry with Oswald from 1955, when Oswald was only 15 or 16. Which I showed last time. On Monday afternoon, November 25th, 1963, this is 2 days after the, 3 days after the assassination, Ferry, moreover, voluntarily presented himself looking for questioning to the New Orleans police, who had been looking for him in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy. The New Orleans District Attorney's Office had earlier received information regarding a relationship between Ferry and accused assassin Lee Harvey Oswald, including allegations that Ferry may have been acquainted with Oswald since Oswald's days in the Civil Air Patrol Youth Organization in 1954-1955. Ferry may have given Oswald instruction in the use of a rifle and may have hypnotized Oswald to shoot the president, and that Ferry was in Texas on the day of the assassination and may have been Oswald's getaway pilot. Ferry denied all the contentions, stating at the time of the president's assassination, he had been in New Orleans, busy with court matters for organized crime figure Carlos Marcello, who had been acquitted of immigration-related charges that same day. Other individuals, including Marcello, Marcello's lawyer, the lawyer's secretary, and FBI agent Regis Kennedy, supported Ferry's alibi. Ferry also gave a detailed account of his whereabouts for the period from the evening of November 22, 1963, until his appearance at the New Orleans police station. Interviews of Ferry's associates and the results of a field investigation verified Ferry's statements. Ferry's assertion that his Stinson Voyager airplane could not be flown at the time of the assassination was later verified by the FBI. Jack Martin, a New Orleans private detective and colleague of Ferry, who had originally mentioned Ferry to New Orleans officials, subsequently informed authorities he had no specific information to support his allegations. Thus, the FBI and the Warren Commission concluded that the stories relating to an Oswald Ferry relationship were unfounded. That's not true. Ferry died in 1967, shortly after New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison announced he was reopening the Kennedy probe and was interested in Ferry's activities in 1963. While there was much speculation that his death may have been suicide, the New Orleans coroner determined the death was a result of natural causes. Questionable. Nevertheless, this further fueled suspicion about his activities. The committee determined that Ferry's activities during the months prior to the assassination of President Kennedy warranted examination. The committee was particularly concerned about the possibility of a relationship between Oswald and Ferry. Several parallels in the lives of the two emerged: complex personality and political beliefs, difficulty in achieving normal social adjustment, and a pattern of visiting the same locality at the same time and engaging in similar activities. A detailed record of Ferry's life and associates is currently available. The committee examined FBI and Secret Service investigative reports generated immediately after the assassination and FBI and INS reports from before and after the assassination. It received information developed during the 1967-68 Garrison investigation, and it examined the files of the extensive investigation of Ferry conducted by the Federal Aviation Administration, Eastern Airlines, and the New Orleans Police from 1961 to 1963, an investigation that was the result of criminal charges against Ferry filed in 1961. Additionally, the committee conducted its own field investigation. Ferry was born in 1918 in Cleveland, Ohio, the son of James Howard Ferry, a police captain and an attorney. Ferry attended parochial grammar and high schools. Although there are no indications that his childhood was anything but normal, numerous acquaintances and associates of Ferry reveal that he grew to be a complex, even bizarre individual. One aptly stated, not inappropriately, he, Ferry, was described as a paradox. His unusual personal appearance was partially a result of the loss of his body hair induced by a rare disease. He wore a makeshift toupee and exaggerated fake eyebrows affixed crudely with glue as compensation. Persons who knew him considered him sloppy and unkempt, with a proclivity for foul language. Ferry was often described as very aggressive and highly obnoxious. He resented authority, was opinionated, and often difficult to get along with. Yet he was able to exert tremendous influence over his close associates, including many young men in his Civil Air Patrol squadron. Several of Ferry's associates indicate he was a homosexual and a misogynist. His sexual exploitation of younger men would eventually cause him numerous problems. Although his formal education was not extensive, Ferry was considered highly intelligent, even brilliant. He had originally studied theology in the hopes of becoming an ordained priest, but he left seminary school before graduation because of, quote, emotional instability, unquote. Later in 1941, he received a Bachelor of Arts degree from Baldwin Wallace College, majoring in philosophy. He also received, through a correspondence course, a doctorate degree in psychology from an unaccredited school, Phoenix University, Bari, Italy. They find out later this is just a complete diploma mill. It was just garbage. In 1957, he traveled to Italy to take the final board exam, supposedly. Ferry spent considerable time studying medicine and psychology, especially the techniques of hypnosis, which he frequently practiced on his young associates. Very important. I'll read that again. Ferry spent considerable time studying medicine and psychology, especially the techniques of hypnosis, which he frequently practiced on his young associates. Ferry even set up a laboratory over his garage where he claimed he lost his hair, alternately attributing it to radiation experiment, chemical explosion, and cancer research experiments. He listed his name in the telephone book as Dr. David Ferry. Many friends did erroneously believe he was a medical doctor and a psychologist. See, that's the whole fake stuff about Ferry. It's all like fake rumored diploma mills and fake theological degrees. This veneer of respectability and achievement could be the reason Ferry referred to his Ph. degree as his most prized possession. Ferry was also philosophically and politically complex. He considered himself a devout Catholic and made several attempts to become a priest, even though he described himself as a theological liberal. He also claimed to be a liberal in his civil rights attitude. He was rabidly anti-communist, however, and frequently critical of each presidential administration for what he perceived to be sellouts to communism. Ferry often spoke to business and civic groups about politics. Ferry associates told FBI agents in 1961 that Ferry had been critical of the Roosevelt administration as it was trying to drive us into communism. Associates also said Ferry was also critical of the Truman administration for the same reason. Ferry was asked to discontinue his remarks at a speaking engagement in July 1961 before the New Orleans chapter of the Military Order of World Wars. His topic was the presidential administration and the Bay of Pigs fiasco. The organization put a stop to Ferry's remarks when he became too critical of President Kennedy. He apparently expressed his views to anyone who would listen. During an interview with IRS auditor in 1960, Ferry was outspoken in his derogatory comments about the United States. He complained bitterly about his alleged tax persecution to such an extent that the agent reported he thought Ferry was actually deranged, a psycho. Ferry's major avocation and occupation was flying. Even associates who were critical of Ferry's character considered him an excellent pilot. An early acquaintance believes that Ferry first started to fly at his father's suggestion to take his mind off his failures at the seminary. He took lessons at SkyTech Airway Service in Cleveland, Ohio, between 1942 and 1945. He then worked as a pilot for an oil drilling firm, which had jobs in South America. When the company went out of business, Ferry tried teaching at Rocky River High School, but he was fired in 1948 for psychoanalyzing his students instead of teaching them. In 1949, Ferry left the Cleveland area after rumors that he had taken several young boys to a house of prostitution circulated through his neighborhood. Although Ferry's exact movements are not known, it appears he had gone to Tampa, Florida, where he received his instrument rating at Sunnyside Flying School. In 1950, Ferry returned to Cleveland. He worked as an insurance inspector and joined the Army Reserve for a three-year stint, leaving with an honorable discharge in 1953. Life started going well for Ferry. In 1951, he submitted an application to Eastern Airlines, omitting details of his past emotional and occupational difficulties. Eastern Airlines hired him in Miami and soon transferred him to New Orleans. Internal Eastern Airlines memoranda indicated Ferry was accepted for employment, but consideration was given to firing him almost immediately for falsifying parts of his application. The New Orleans branch was advised to keep Ferry only until a replacement could be found and a close watch on Ferry's progress was recommended. Initial reports, however, were favorable. Ferry was considered by his fellow pilots to be doing a good job, although he was odd at times. Eastern decided to retain him. Ferry approached his job enthusiastically, devoting his own time to talking at schools and clubs to promote interest in aviation and travel in the Southwest area. In 1953, the president of Eastern wrote him a letter personally commending Ferry's efforts on behalf of the company. This early record of dedication and competence may have accounted for Ferry's longevity as an Eastern Airlines captain, despite complaints through the years. Ultimately, the infractions became too serious, and after a long investigation and a hearing process that lasted from 1961 to 1963, Ferry lost his job. Ferry had always been engrossed in activities related to flying, including the Civil Air Patrol, which he had first joined in Cleveland. Over the years, his difficulties with the hierarchy and authorities of the Civil Air Patrol would increase, but Ferry remained intensely popular with many of the members and enjoyed a reputation as a first-rate instructor and organizer. Gene Knotts, an aviatrix of national renown, stated, "He had done more for the Civil Air Patrol than anyone else and built up the squadron to one of the biggest squadrons in the state of Ohio." Ferry also built the same reputation with many CAP cadets in the New Orleans area. One CAP commander said, "David Ferry is a good organizer. He made the CAP at the New Orleans airport everything it is today. He has a large following among the cadets of the CAP and is an excellent flying instructor." By 1953, there were about 80 cadets assigned to his squadron. Ferry spent about 6 hours a week in official CAP activity, much of his own time as associating with his cadets. Ferry became known for his enthusiastic approach to cadet training, emphasizing tutoring in science and mathematics and putting cadets in charge of their own discipline. The squadron had an award-winning drill team. His appeal to several young men may have been related to his taking an extraordinary interest in them. He gave them flying instructions and flight time in his own airplane. He often gave parties at his residence where liquor flowed freely, and he offered his home as a place for the boys to stay when they were unhappy at home. He urged several boys to join the armed forces and begin careers in aviation or to join seminaries. Many of Ferry's cadets became involved in Ferry's wide spectrum of other activities. Ferry's tremendous influence and close association with these young men eventually became a controversial subject with many parents. Ferry did not bother to renew his Cap Commander charter when it ran out in 1954, although he continued to wear the insignia of the Cap on his fatigues. He did renew his Commander character charter in 1959, when he augmented his cadet standard Cap rifle training by instituting an association with the New Orleans Cadet Rifle Club. Ferry also started a group called the Falcon Squadron, composed of Ferry's closest Cap associates. A group within this group, the Omnipotence, was allegedly started to train cadets in what to do in the event of a major attack on the United States. All right, that's Gladio stuff. Ferry's job and ownership of an airplane enabled him to travel around the country with relative ease. He told officials he frequently traveled to Texas and other parts of the South, including Miami. He also visited New York on occasion. The amount of time Ferry spent in these other cities could not be determined. In August 1959, while in Miami, Ferry was put under a 24-hour surveillance by customs agents who believed he was involved in gun smuggling. Following a brief investigation, including a tapping of his telephone conversations, it was determined that Ferry was not involved in any illegal activity, but merely planning an outing for his scouts. The investigation was dropped. Ferry also became involved in other activities. In 1959, he had found an outlet for his political fanaticism in the anti-Castro movement. By early 1961, Ferry and a young man whom Ferry had first met in the Cap, Leighton Martins, were working with Sergio Arcacha Smith, head of the Cuban Revolutionary Front delegation in New Orleans. Ferry soon became Smith's eager partner in counter-revolutionary activities. He reportedly built two miniature submarines, which he planned to use for an attack on Havana Harbor, obtained several rifles and mortars for the proposed invasion, and was reportedly teaching Cubans how to fly. Further, several of Ferry's cadets claimed to have taken trips to Cuba in Ferry's airplane. Ferry was also involved with Arcacha Smith, Adventure Gordon Novel, and Leighton Martins in a raid on a munitions dump in Houma, Louisiana. In September 1961, the U.S. Border Patrol received information that Ferry was attempting to purchase a C-47 airplane for $30,000 and reportedly had a cache of arms in the New Orleans area. The report was never verified. There were also unverified reports that Ferry provided Arcacha Smith with personal financial assistance. Arcacha Smith wrote Eastern Airlines then president Eddie Rickenbacker on Ferry's behalf, requesting a 60 or 90 day leave with pay for full-time work for the CRC. The request was denied. Nevertheless, Ferry's vacation in April 1961 coincided with the Bay of Pigs invasion. Ferry's role, if any, is not known. There's a lot more information that's been known about this guy. We'll find out. The CRC in New Orleans was affiliated with the main branch of the CRC in Miami, which had been receiving funds from the U.S. government. Some of these funds may have been disseminated to the New Orleans branch to cover operating costs. Nevertheless, there is no evidence Ferry received funds from either the CRC or the U.S. government, and no evidence that Ferry was connected in any way with the U.S. government. Well, that's not the case. Ferry's assistant and interest appears to have been completely voluntary. No. See, they didn't get all the information right here. During this time, Ferry had continued to have personal problems. In 1960, he had provoked the ire of other Cap commanders while on a cadet campout. The incident ended with Ferry withdrawing his cadets from the outing and eventually led to his permanent resignation from the Cap in 1960. Ferry's troubles intensified when charges were brought against him by parents of boys who had run away from home. In one instance, Ferry had gained entrance to the New Orleans Detention Center to visit one runaway boy by signing himself in as a doctor. The parents of another boy complained to authorities that their son was staying with Ferry. As a result, Ferry was arrested in August 8, 1961 for contributing to the delinquency of a juvenile. Cuban exile leader Arcacha Smith intervened on Ferry's behalf by telling police that the boy would be returned to his parents if they did not press charges against Ferry. But Ferry was arrested again on August 11, 1961 for crime against nature on a 15-year-old boy and indecent behavior with three others. An intensive New Orleans police investigation of the charges against Ferry produced statements from several boys that Ferry had committed indecent acts with them. The boys also told investigators Ferry had told them he had had homosexual relations with a married man in Houston. On August 26th, Eastern Airlines removed him from the payroll for an indefinite period, and the Federal Aviation Administration then opened its own investigation into the charges. With his problems mounting, Ferry sought legal aid from New Orleans attorney G. Ray Gill Sr. Ferry later testified that he and Gill had entered into an agreement in March 1962 that Gill would represent Ferry in his legal difficulties in return for Ferry's research and investigative work on other cases for Gill. Ferry also testified that he also entered into a similar arrangement in February 1962 with Guy Bannister, former FBI agent who ran a private investigative firm. By the terms of the agreement, Ferry's work for Bannister included analyzing autopsy reports in payment for Bannister's investigative services. Bannister stated he handled Ferry's case personally, which he did. He testified to the Eastern Airlines. We'll find that out. Ferry may have first met Bannister late in 1960 or early 1961 when Bannister, also a strong anti-communist, was helping to establish the Friends of Democratic Cuba organization as an adjunct to Sergio Arcacha Smith's CRC. At the time, Bannister's investigative business and the CRC were both located in the Balter Building. In February 1961, Bannister was conducting background investigations of the members of the CRC from a list provided by Arcacha Smith. In early 1962, both moved their offices to the Newman Building, which carried the two addresses for the two streets it faced, 531 Lafayette and 544 Camp Street. Jack Martin, a private investigator associated with Bannister, may also have been contacted by Ferry for assistance on his case. Ferry testified in August 1963 that he had helped Martin on a case involving a phony religious order in Louisville, Kentucky, in November of 1961. Later, Martin wrote letters to the FAA and Eastern Airlines on Ferry's behalf. With this assistance, Ferry was able to resolve many of his difficulties. At the end of February 1962, Ferry was tried and acquitted of the charges of extortion. The other charges were nulla prosequid in November 1962. So he was trying to extort the kids who testified against him. You'll see this. And then the nulla prosequid means the office of the district attorney chose not to prosecute. Ferry managed to stay afloat financially despite his loss of income from Eastern Airlines in 1961. Although he was categorized as a poor credit risk in October 1962 by the New Orleans Retail Credit Bureau, Ferry made payments on his car and met living expenses. Meanwhile, he was also attempting to be reinstated as an Eastern pilot. Attorney G. Ray Gill notified Eastern when the last of the charges against Ferry had been nulla prosequid. Eastern responded with a letter inviting Ferry to discuss the charges at a meeting in Miami. Ferry did not go. Instead, several individuals, including one of the boys who had been named in a sex offense charge against him, wrote to Eastern to plead that Ferry be reinstated. Ferry also filed a grievance against Eastern. Then, in February 1963, he went to Miami with Attorney Gill for the hearing regarding his dismissal. Eastern ruled against him. Ferry filed another grievance. Hearing dates were scheduled and rescheduled. During this period, Ferry was often seen at Bannister's offices in 544 Camp Street as he prepared his case. Ferry's final grievance hearing was set for July 15, 1963 in Miami. Ferry, Gill, and Bannister were in Miami in July 15th, 16th, and 17th, while Eastern Airlines presented its case against Ferry. The record of those hearings reveals that the company's charges were based on Ferry's deliberate omissions and inaccuracies in his original application to the company, charges of Ferry's moral turpitude, and his having misrepresented himself as a medical doctor and psychologist. The hearings were resumed on August 5th. Testifying in Ferry's defense were former CAP cadet John Irion, Ferry's longtime friend James Llewellyn, Ferry's investigator Guy Bannister, and Ferry himself. Leighton Martins provided a sworn deposition in defense of Ferry's character. Bannister testified to Ferry's good character supposedly based on his own investigation of Ferry. In cross-examination, Bannister could not rationalize to the satisfaction of the hearing board the reason for Ferry's vituperative remarks in 1961 against President Kennedy, nor could he adequately explain Ferry's involvement with a questionable church group. CIA front. On September 30th, Ferry received a final decision from the Eastern Appeal Board. It unanimously upheld his discharge. By the fall of 1963, Ferry had become actively involved in the defense investigation of federal charges of fraudulent birth certificate against Carlos Marcello, an alleged organized crime leader in New Orleans. It's not an allegation. He's an organized crime leader. Ties to Marcello continued through Ferry's lifetime. As late as 1966, 6 months prior to his death, Ferry was working with known Marcello associate Jacob Nastasi in an air cargo service. According to information developed during an FBI anti-racketeering investigation of Nastasi, Ferry had previously worked with Marcello Associates in another airline company known as United Air Taxi Service. Ferry's involvement with Marcello may have begun as early as spring 1961. An unconfirmed Border Patrol report of February 1962 alleges that Ferry was the pilot who flew Carlos Marcello back to the United States from Guatemala after he'd been deported in April 1961 as part of the U.S. Attorney General Robert Kennedy's crackdown on organized crime. This may have helped Ferry establish an enduring relationship with the Marcello organized crime family. The return of Marcello to the United States coincided chronologically with Ferry's activities with the Cuban Revolutionary Council. According to Carlos Quiroga, a Cuban who had been involved with the CRC, Ferry often provided Arcacha Smith with funds, stating, Ferry lent him, Arcacha Smith, money when he needed it for his family. He, Ferry, had $100 bills around all the time, even after he had lost his job with the airlines. An FBI report of April 1961 indicated Marcello offered Arcacha Smith a deal whereby Marcello would make a substantial donation to the movement in return for concessions in Cuba after Castro's overthrow. One explanation of Ferry's ability to provide funds to Arcacha Smith may be that he acted as Marcello's financial conduit. Another indication of an early Ferry relationship with the Marcello organized crime family may be the legal assistance that Marcello's lawyer, Jack Wasserman, provided to Ferry associates Leighton Martins, who identified himself to police as Arcacha Smith's second-in-command, and Andrew Blackmon. Both had been arrested shortly after Ferry's arrest for indecent behavior. Ferry's ties to the Marcello organized crime family continued through his association with G. Ray Gill Sr., who was also attorney of record for Carlos Marcello. Ferry told FBI that he had begun work on Marcello's case after his last Eastern grievance hearing. In telling the Bureau about his work for Marcello, however, he mentioned only activities in October and November. Ferry said he went to Guatemala on business for Marcello from October 11th to October 18th and from October 30th to November 1st. The day after Marcello's trial started, February 5th, Ferry purchased a .38 caliber revolver. On the weekends of November 9th and 16th, Ferry stayed at Churchill Farms, Marcello's Louisiana country estate. He said he had gone there to map out strategy for Marcello's trial, right? This is before the assassination, like 1 week before. New Orleans police records for November 22nd, 1963 indicate that Guy Bannister pistol-whipped Jack Martin on the evening of the assassination in a heated argument over long-distance telephone calls. Although Martin reported the assault to the police, he refused to press charges against Bannister. Within 48 hours, however, Martin had the entire New Orleans Police Department hunting for David Ferry. He told the police that Ferry may have been involved in the Kennedy assassination. Specifically, he suspected that Ferry was in Texas on the day of the assassination, and that he was supposed to have been the getaway pilot in the assassination, and that Ferry had known Oswald from their days together in the Civil Air Patrol, when Ferry had given Oswald instructions in the use of a rifle. In an attempt to locate Ferry for questioning, police arrested two Ferry associates, Leighton Martins and Alvin Buboff, at Ferry's residence and charged them with vagrancy. While Buboff was uncooperative during the questioning, Martins was more talkative. He said Gill had come by to relay a message to Ferry that his library card was found among Oswald's effects. Martin's story was unsubstantiated. It's probably some code word or something like that. They actually took him literally. They're like mob people. Come on. Ferry returned to New Orleans on the afternoon of November 25th. He and attorney Gill appeared at the district attorney's office around 4:30 p.m. He was questioned by the New Orleans police, the U.S. Secret Service, and the FBI. He denied ever seeing Oswald before. He's lying. Ferry also said that he had been in New Orleans until at least 9 p.m. on November 22nd, celebrating Marcello's trial victory at the Royal Orleans. He said he then left the city with two friends for some rest and relaxation. Ferry's account of his travels between November 22nd and November 25th contained some contradictions. Ferry said he left New Orleans by automobile, bound for Houston, and accompanied by Melvin Coffey and Al Buboff. The group checked in at the Alamo Motel on early November 23rd. That date on the motel registration card was written over November 22nd notation. The motel employee said that was because of the early morning hour of the check-in, however, and that he was certain the correct date was the 23rd. On the afternoon of November 23rd, Ferry said he, Buboff, and Coffey went figure skating at the Winterland skating rink. The three then went to the Bel Air skating rink before driving 1 hour to Galveston, Texas, where they arrived at 9 p.m. and a short time later checked into the Driftwood Motel. Check-in and check-out times for the Houston and Galveston hotels conflict. Alamo Motel records in Houston indicate that Ferry and his friends checked into the hotel early on November 23rd and did not leave until 8 or 9 p.m. on November 24th. Yet the registration records and witnesses at the Driftwood in Galveston show the three registered late on November 23rd and checked out at 10 a.m. on November 24th. Records from the motels indicate the group made a number of phone calls. Two calls were made from the Alamo Motel, went to radio stations WSHO and WDSH in New Orleans. A collect call went to the Town & Country Motel, Marcello's New Orleans headquarters. Evidence indicated that Ferry conducted his own investigation into the Kennedy assassination. Oswald's former landlady in New Orleans, Miss Jessie Garner, told the committee she recalled that Ferry visited her home on the night of the assassination and asked about Oswald's library card. Miss Garner would not talk to Ferry. A neighbor of Oswald's, Miss Doris Eames, told New Orleans District Attorney Investigators 1968 that Ferry had come by her house after the assassination, inquiring if Mr. Eames had any information regarding Oswald's library card. Eames told Ferry he had seen Oswald in the public library, but apparently no information about the library card Oswald used. Ferry also talked with several former members of the Civil Air Patrol in an attempt to find out if any former cadets recalled Lee Harvey Oswald in Ferry's squadron. Among those contacted was former cadet Roy McCoy, who told the FBI that Ferry had come by looking for photographs of the cadets to see if Oswald was pictured in any photos of Ferry's squadron. The implications of Ferry's associations, his activities, and allegations that Ferry and Oswald had been seen together in Clinton, Louisiana, in the late summer of 1963 and were acquainted while both were active in the Civil Air Patrol in 1955, are discussed in the Anti-Castro Cuban Conspiracy and the Organized Crime Conspiracy sections of the committee report. So that's another part of this. Submitted by Gaetan J. Fonzi, investigator, Patricia M. Orr, researcher. So that's just one part, David Ferry, of this. So there's probably another one, the Castro-Cuban Conspiracy. And the other one, that's probably more reading. I read this off the Mary Farrell Foundation website. But there is just some other interesting things. Like we can go, and I'm going to pull this up again. This is the kind of raw files from the HSCA report. So I'll pull that up right now. Let's So this is it. Let's see. But there's just interesting, like there's things that are underlined here where they flat out say Ferry is a CIA agent. Like, let me see if I can find it. I mean, it's incredible. Like, yeah. Gaudet, that he is a CIA agent. Let's see. There's another one that where they just come out and flat out say that he's flying with the CIA. Ferry's involvement with the CIA seems to stem mainly from his anti-Castro paramilitary activity, although there is a suggestion that he was at one time a pilot for the agency. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, he flew light planes commercially in the Cleveland, Ohio area. He was rated by his colleagues as an outstanding pilot. In the middle of the 1950s, there's an untraceable gap in his career. Then he turns up as an Eastern Airlines pilot. Although he supposedly obtained an instrument rating at the Sunnyside Flying School in Tampa, Florida, there's no record that any ever such school ever existed. So it's another fake thing. A clue to Ferry's activities may lie in the loss of hair he suffered. A fellow employee at Eastern recalls that when Ferry first joined the line, he was handsome and friendly, but in the end became moody and paranoiac, afraid the communists were out to get him. The personality change coincided with a gradual loss of hair. First, a bald spot appeared, which Ferry explained was caused by acid dripping from a plane battery. Then hair began falling out in clumps. Ferry desperately studied medicine to try to halt the process until his body was entirely devoid of hair. One speculation is that he was moonlighting and suffered a physiological reaction to exposure to the extreme altitudes required for clandestine flights. Chinese nationalist U-2 pilots reportedly have suffered the same hair loss phenomenon. One of Ferry's covert tasks in the New Orleans area was to drill small teams in guerrilla warfare. One of his young proteges has revealed that he trained some of the Civil Air Patrol cadets and Cubans and formed them into five-man small weapons units, this under the auspices of the Marine Corps and State Department. Coupled with this is the information from another former protege that Ferry confided he was working for the CIA rescuing Cubans out of Castro prisons, and on one occasion was called to Miami so that the CIA could test him to see if he was the type of person who told his business to anybody, right? So Miami was the headquarters for everything Mongoose. In a speech before the Military Order of World Wars in New Orleans in late 1961, Ferry related that he had trained pilots in Guatemala for the Bay of Pigs and professed bitter disappointment that they were not used. That's from Ramparts. So there's a lot more. Like, there's more stuff on Probe on Ferry. I can read more of this. The probe refocused on Ferry on December 15th. He was brought in for further questioning. It didn't take the DA's men long to poke holes in Ferry's story. Melvin Coffey, one of his companions on the 1963 trip, deposed that it was not a sudden inspiration. Question, was the trip arranged before? Answer, yes. Question, how long before? Answer, a couple of days. The probers also determined that no one had taken along any shotguns on the so-called goose hunting trip. In Houston, the ice skating alibi was similarly discredited. In 1963, the FBI had interviewed Chuck Rowland, proprietor of the Winterland Skating Rink. Ferry contacted him by telephone November 22, 1963, and asked for the skating schedule, a Bureau report, one of the few unclassified documents on Ferry reveals. Mr. Ferry stated he was coming in down from out of town and desired to do some skating while in Houston. On November 23, 1963, between 3:30 and 5:30 p.m., Mr. Ferry and two companions came to the rink and talked to Mr. Rowland. The report continues that Ferry and Rowland had a short general conversation, and that Ferry remarked that he and his companions would be in and out of the skating rink during the weekend. When Garrison's men recently talked to Rowland, they obtained pertinent facts that the FBI had either missed or failed to report in 1963. Rowland was certain that none of the three men in Ferry's party had ice skated. Ferry had spent the entire 2 hours he was at the rink standing by a pay telephone and finally received a call. At Houston International Airport, more information was gleaned. Air Service personnel seemed to recall that in 1963, Ferry had access to an airplane based in Houston. In this craft, the flight to Matamoros would take little more than an hour. So maybe he flew out of there. Ferry had patently lied about the purpose of the trip. One of the standard tactics of bank robbers is to escape from the scene of the crime in a hot car that cannot be traced to them and then switch to a cold car of their own to complete the getaway. Garrison considers it possible that Ferry may have been the pilot of a second craft in a two-stage escape of the Dallas assassins to south of the border, or may have been slated to be a backup pilot in the event of contingency plans were activated. Did Ferry know Oswald? The pilot denied it, but the evidence mounts that he did. I think he obviously did. For example, there's now in Garrison's hands information that when Oswald was arrested by Dallas police, he had in his possession a current New Orleans library card issued to David Ferry. Reinforcing the validity of this information is a Secret Service report on the questioning of Ferry by that agency when he was in federal custody in 1963. During an otherwise mild interrogation, Ferry was asked, strangely enough, if he lent his library card to Oswald. No, he replied, producing a card from the New Orleans Public Library in the name of Dr. David Ferry. That card had expired. When he realized he was a suspect in Garrison's current investigation, Ferry seemed to deteriorate. By the time he died on February 22, 1967, he was in a nervous wreck, subsisting on endless cigarettes and cups of coffee and enough tranquilizers to pacify an army. He had sought out the press only days before his death, labeling the probe a fraud and complaining he was a victim of a witch hunt. Oh, wow. I heard that before. I suppose he has me pegged as a getaway pilot, he remarked bitterly. When Garrison delivered his epitaph of Ferry as one of history's most important individuals, most of the press winked knowingly. The probe was, after all, a publicity stunt, and the DA had his headlines. Now that his prime suspect had conveniently passed away, he had the perfect excuse to inter his probe alongside the deceased pilot. But for DA Jim Garrison, that was not the end. It was the beginning. I mean, there's just so much here. There's so much information. Like, this whole CIA, there's just more CIA stuff. All these things. Ferry, Arkacha Smith. There's an underlined thing. I mean, these I should probably just read through. I'll probably have to do a part three because there's so much information. So that story that he was I mean, it's incredible because that's where Oswald was at Sugi, I think in 59, associated with Civilian Air Patrol, right? But at Sugi was where they flew the U-2 planes out of. So was Ferry involved in something like that is I think a good question. There are just other like elements of the CIA and attachments to the CIA that he was at. And he had been stabbed. Ferry had been stabbed, I think, around then. There were indications that he was flying to the island south of Cuba. I think I forgot the name of it, but it's pretty remarkable. And there's other references in here to Tracy Barnes. The movement to free Cuba, headed by Tracy Barnes, a known CIA asset. Like, you can just look up Tracy Barnes. So his connection to Ferry and all these other characters out of New Orleans. So Ferry was something else. Interesting. And I think involved in the assassination. It doesn't seem like the timing. If you can spot something, maybe the spotting of him in New Orleans in the 22nd is fake. But he's clearly like hanging out with Marcello before the assassination. It's incredible that he was there, I think the 9th and the 16th on the weekends with Marcello before. So it's like another connection of the mob to the event. But yeah, that was Who Was David Ferry Part 2. So I guess there'll be a Part 3. So thank you for listening.